December 14th, I believe, of 2022 that had DeSantis in the 50s, Trump in the 30s. I mean, this did not look like a guy that was going to win. The rebirth of the campaign, though, came. I think Steve Bannon was a big influence here. It came when he addressed CPAC in the spring of 2023, gave a 2-hour long speech that's one of the darkest campaign speeches that has ever happened anywhere. That's where he uses that famous line. In 2016, I said, I am your voice. Now I say, I am your retribution. And it outlines this, we are going to go and we are going to root out. He doesn't use the word vermin, but everything else.
Right.
We're going to root out the deep state. We're going to utterly annihilate and destroy our enemies and the people that have come after me because they really want to go after you. And that becomes the theme of his campaign. He hadn't been indicted yet, but it was clear the indictments were coming. You know, Jack Smith was well underway. People were expecting something to come out of New York and the DA and even Georgia, which would come quite a while later. But the indictments were coming. And as they came, this has become the central theme of his campaign, which is, you know, there's not a lot of specificity to it, but we're going to utterly destroy our enemies within our own government, our domestic enemies. I get the sense that he's primarily talking about Republicans who used to be with him, but were now against him. And then maybe after that, prosecutors, FBI, anybody who's been involved in any of the legal cases against him. And then after that, oh, by the way, like, you know, Democrats, you know, Joe Biden.
This is the Commonwealth Club radio program. Thanks for joining us as we hear from Jonathan Karl and Jonathan Swan. I'm Gloria Duffy. Get the inside story on Commonwealth Club, our events, travel program, and more by subscribing to our email newsletter at commonwealthclub.org/email. Now, back to our program.
What is your reporting and just your knowledge of his psychology tell you about what we should expect next year when he's likely in court for at least one criminal trial during the election season? What do you expect to see there?
A defining characteristic for Trump, and before he got into politics, but certainly since you and I have been covering him and as a political figure, is his unpredictability. His volatility, you know, he's mercurial. He goes up, he goes down. He, you know, he changes course. He, you know, people try to keep up with him. He's by the gut and he's not particularly strategic. It's all, you know, in the moment. But I think that he is actually more volatile now than he's ever been. And we don't get as much of a sense of that because we see much less of him now. And that's starting to change as we see him out. And as it's starting to change, by the way, just look at the storyline over the last couple of weeks when he is coming out and he's talking about January 6th prisoners as hostages. He's talking about his enemies as vermin, kind of using a Third Reich imagery. Every day there's something else that seems to go further. He's talking about prosecuting his enemies. So I don't think that we know what we're in for. And I think that the idea that this is going to be a kind of a slow, steady campaign where he's going to accumulate delegates and then win the nomination and then have a couple of big debates against Biden and give a bunch of incendiary speech. I'm fearful about what the next year is going to look like. And I'm also completely humbled. I don't think I can predict what he's going to be like and what his psychology will be like as he's sitting through these cases.
Well, the thing I find, like, I think about it all the time and, you know, when I'm doing my reporting on Trump right now is, you know, we can't assume anything, but if we assume that there will be a January 6th trial in Washington, D.C. next year, and let's say for purposes of conversation that that's the only trial, all the rest of them get delayed. He will be in a courtroom every day for 3 months, maybe from early April, maybe or late March to maybe mid-July. And there won't be cameras broadcasting it. So I think so much, and your book kind of gets into the sort of the way he warps the information space, but you roll the tape forward in our minds, it'll be Trump in a courtroom. He'll leave the courtroom every day, do a sort of wave the bloody shirt press conference on the courthouse steps every day. You know, I'm Nelson Mandela, Joe Biden's trying to lock me up. This is like a third banana republic, blah, blah, blah. Gets in his motorcade with a dashboard cam, OJ style kind of news coverage to the airport, flies home to Trump Tower, sleeps there, comes back, repeat, repeat, repeat. And one thing I sort of am thinking a lot about is what effect this has on the public, because the only person who's in the courtroom as a participant that they're going to be hearing from in that period is Donald Trump. The rest of it will be mediated through people like you and me and journalists and whatever. And we're so siloed in our information ecosystem now that I honestly don't know what effect this is all going to have. And it's one of the big unknowns, I think, about next year. I just wonder how you're sort of thinking about that prospect as we head into next year.
It poses a tremendous challenge to you and I as reporters, but perhaps more so to news organizations. Individual reporters will do what we can do, but how do you allocate resources and column inches and airtime? And you're right, I think it's most likely that it's one trial and it's the federal election interference case. It's an historic event. It's a trial that will be studied in schools at all levels for decades to come. It's hugely consequential. But it's happening against the backdrop of a campaign. And one of the concerns I've had, and this concerns about my own reporting as well, is that we spend so much time focusing on these cases, which deserve the attention that we give to them, and so little time in comparison to what Trump is actually thinking and what's in his head right now and what his plans are and what it would look like if he returned to the White House. I think that's changed a little bit in the last few weeks. I hope that this book I've written has helped contribute in some way to that, and I hope it does, not in terms of the coverage, but in terms of the mind of voters. He's going to have the loudest megaphone on these cases. That's an excellent point. He's going to be the one you're going to be hearing from. The voices of the reporters that are going to be in that courtroom every year, our voices are never going to be as loud. And we're going to be straight to the facts and down the line, and this is what happened. But, you know, he's going to be what breaks through. And we need to be sure that, given that this is playing out against the backdrop of a campaign, that we're also covering that campaign. And the court drama is not the campaign. I mean, Trump would like to make it as such, I think. But it's not the campaign.
Well, let's talk until we get to audience questions. Let's spend this last little bit of time talking about looking ahead, and you get into this in your book. What does your reporting tell you about how a second Trump term in office might differ from his first term?
Well, and by the way, I'm incredibly honored that you're here with me, and we have a lot of conversations, you know, over lunch or see you on the campaign trail or see whatever. I mean, it's great to have this conversation. You have done some phenomenal reporting really over the last few years about Trump and personnel. There's two aspects of it. There's what happened, especially at the tail end of his presidency, when John McEntee overtook the presidential personnel office. This young aide, he had just turned 30. He had never hired or fired anybody before, but he takes over presidential personnel in February of 2020. And presidential personnel is basically in charge of the hiring and firing of 4,000 political appointees in the federal government. And he uses that office to begin, and he doesn't get very far in it. It's really just starting, but to try to weed out people in the administration that are insufficiently loyal to Donald Trump. His biggest crowning achievement is at the Pentagon after the election when, you know, McEntee orchestrates, you know, it's fully doing Trump's bidding here, but McEntee is the one that carries it out, the decapitation of the entire political leadership at the Pentagon, or the top political leadership, starting with Defense Secretary Esper, and then puts in what are deemed the real loyalists. And you did that amazing reporting that, like, back in your Axios days about how he also sent over a directive, you know, four-line directive, get us out of Afghanistan, get us out of Syria and Iraq, get us out of Germany, and get us out of Somalia. And then I take a dive into that story in this book to get the real gruesome details about how that directive came to be and also the impact it had and the way it was received at the Pentagon and the way they pulled the plug on it. But I had looked at McEntee and made a comment about him in a piece I had done for The Atlantic before Betrayal came out as kind of the man who made January 6th possible. And what I meant by that is he had gone through and set a tone that loyalty was going to be the operating principle in that White House, which, by the way, it really hadn't been. I mean, there was so much infighting, made it good for, you know, there was a lot of fodder for reporters to go, because you could always count on factions fighting back and forth. McEntee was there to kind of get rid of anybody who wasn't willing to do anything that the boss wanted. So I think a second Trump term kind of starts where the first one left off, which is January 6th. Because McEntee, you know, and it doesn't need to be McEntee, by the way. I say it's McEntee or somebody like him will be going through, and you were the one that first highlighted this. There's a guy that worked for McEntee who had done some obscure podcast talking about what he learned from presidential personnel and all that, and said the most important thing that you can hire for is loyalty, not policy, because you can teach policy, but you can't teach loyalty. So in other words, we don't even care what these people believe in as long as they're loyal. So a second Trump term doesn't have the people who kind of offered some guardrails, maybe overrated guardrails, but some guardrails. I mean, I don't know if Jared Kushner is back. It looks like he's not, but who knows, even if that changes. There's nobody like Bill Barr. There's nobody like Don McGahn or Pat Cipollone. There's nobody like Mattis or Tillerson or John Kelly. These people that were, you know, serious people that were brought in and truly saw their sworn duty to abide by the Constitution, not the man. That's, I think, the most important thing to understand. And you've also reported about how they want to do this beyond just political appointees, but it's like the entire civil service, not the 4,000 political appointees, but the 40 or 50,000 civil servants who have, you know, served from administration to administration. I mean, they want to get rid of those people as well.
And I think one thing that people don't always think about in this conversation is he will come in, if he comes into power in 2025, there'll be a different judiciary than the judiciary that greeted him in 2017. You know, it's a judiciary that Donald Trump himself largely shaped. And, you know this from your reporting, they learned a lot over the 4 years. You know, I still find that there's this tendency to treat everyone around Trump like they're circus clowns. But actually, people like Stephen Miller, just take immigration as one example. You know, the 2017, they did this botched travel ban that was, you know, barely written in a legible fashion. By the end, they'd virtually invalidated the asylum system. I mean, they'd learned a lot. I mean, it was actually a pretty sophisticated policy operation in certain areas by the end. And they learned a lot about how to wield power. They also learned a lot about how to abuse the nominating process. I mean, you talked about all these people that were overwhelmingly confirmed by the Senate, but by the end, he'd figured out how to use acting secretaries who were probably not confirmable. So I think that's another part of it that is really important to bear in mind, is that one way or another, Donald Trump is going to get the people he wants in key jobs. That's my view, having kind of fairly coldly assessed the situation.
So let me ask you a question, if you don't mind, then, because I think you're really onto something that's important and underappreciated by this. Because Senate confirmation is a check on power by design. And they did find the loopholes, but they did use and abide by the Vacancies Act, which allows you to put people in. And because you did have a White House counsel's office that was staffed by serious lawyers who felt it was their job to make sure that the president didn't violate the law, you know, kind of basic. So this is why, like, Rick Grenell could be put in place as the director of national intelligence, in a rather absurd appointment, you know, taking an internet troll and putting him in charge of the entire intelligence community. They were able to do that because he had been confirmed as ambassador to Germany. So he was able to serve, but just for a time. And, you know, eventually you got a permanent replacement. There were limits, you know. Matt Whitaker was in there just for a time as attorney general. Eventually you get the more serious Bill Barr, who can be confirmed. If Trump decides just to go for acting secretaries, like, across the board, what stops him?
The law is very poorly drafted and quite complicated. But as I understand it, what he can effectively get away with is you nominate someone, then you can withdraw their nominations like 210 days. Basically, you can buy yourself something like 600 days with an acting, like, if you really want to abuse the system and stretch it out, you get a lot of time out of these jobs. The other thing you can do is just put somebody, like, take someone like Kash Patel, who even if it's a solid Republican Senate, this is who guy Trump wanted to put in as deputy CIA director at the end of his first term, or deputy FBI.
FBI, yeah. I mean, there were like five different jobs that they had him in line.
Bill Barr said, over my dead body, will you do that? So anyway, it didn't happen. You know, and Kash Patel now is sort of stayed in Trump's orbit, writing, you know, children's books that glorify Trump, whatever. Anyway, he's someone that even with a Republican Senate would be probably pretty hard to confirm. But let's say you put him in as deputy CIA director, a position that doesn't require Senate confirmation, but it's understood within the agency that he's in charge.
Yeah.
This is the president's guy. He's in charge. There's so many things you could do. I mean, put him over at the National Security Council and run things from there. I mean, there are just so many different permutations. One thing I think you've learned, it's clear in your book, I've learned as well through this, and we'll get to the questions in a sec, is I think what the Trump era has taught us is that so many of the quote-unquote guardrails are not actually laws. They're norms.
They're customs
and they're self-restraint and all these, like this sort of orchestra of, you know, some laws, some norms. But when you have somebody who has no self-restraint and no intention of abiding by norms, the system's not set up to deal with that person. The laws are not set up to deal with that person. And in the last 3 years, Democrats, and to be fair, I guess they haven't really had the votes to do it, but they haven't passed any legislation to close any of these loopholes that Donald Trump identified. So the system hasn't actually been strengthened or bolstered during the Biden era. It's waiting for Donald Trump to come back to it in largely the same condition he left it.
Yeah, really the only thing that was bolstered and reformed was the Electoral Count Act, you know, to kind of make it abundantly clear that no, the vice president cannot unilaterally choose the next president.
But they didn't do anything with, you know,
the Vacancies Act or any of these
confirmation.
And I know you want to go to questions, but you're entirely correct, the question of norms and customs. But there's another thing that kind of haunts me. If Trump gets elected after all of this, he will have gotten away with everything and he'll be president again. What if he just doesn't even go by the law either? What if he says, okay, that all your 270 days and all this electoral for the Vacancies Act, well, he just says, you know what? That's my attorney general.
Right. Now, this is the question of how do you enforce law?
Yeah. I mean, the executive branch enforces the laws, right?
No, that's right. That's right. That's right.
And this is...
Well, especially when you get into the question of like, self-pardons or ordering your DOJ to drop cases. I mean, all of
abiding
this stuff.
Abiding by court orders.
It's all uncharted territory. It's all uncharted territory. Okay, let's do a few audience questions. We'll probably have time for a couple. Do you believe Kash Patel's threat that Trump will come after reporters, or do you believe his campaign's distancing itself from that comment?
I don't really take that threat entirely seriously. Kash Patel made that comment in an interview on The War Room with Steve Bannon. He was, you know, and Bannon got them all. But it sure is possible. I mean...
Well, Trump himself has said he wants to go after Comcast and NBC and whatever.
I mean, he said that... By the way, he said that some of that stuff in the 2016 campaign. I mean, this is not...
100%. And he didn't, during his first term, like, he wanted to intervene with AT&T and Time Warner. He didn't. Let me rephrase that question a little bit. Trump did say some of this same stuff in 2016 and in his first term. He never really fully followed through with the media.
Yeah.
You know, it was rhetoric. Do you think it will be much the same in a second term, or do you think actually, no, he might operationalize it?
I think that we should fear that he could operationalize some of this. And I'll give you one very specific personal experience on this. I was president of the White House Correspondents Association in 2020. And the White House Correspondents Association, among our responsibilities, is to kind of handle the seating in the briefing room. And there's a reason for that. This gives some distance from the president. The president could be choosing, you know, I want to have all my friends here and I want to kick everybody else out of the White House. And we fight and occasionally we'll go to court to fight for our ability to make sure that everybody has access. But a lot of this is customs and norms. So during COVID, you only had 14 seats in the briefing room, and Trump came to really resent that. And we rotated so all different news organizations could get in and out. But he resented when he would go out there and he would see me, he would see Phil Rucker, he would see maybe Maggie Haberman, he would see whoever. He really resented that he was seeing actual journalists and not you know, 14 Sean Hannity clones in the briefing room. And they put a lot of pressure on me, which I did not abide by, and I didn't bow to put friendly voices. And it almost came to a crisis. I mean, there was a moment where they, there was one moment where they wanted to pull Caitlin Collins, who was, CNN White House reporter at the time, out of the briefing room in the middle of a briefing, one of those COVID briefings. There was a moment where they tried to put somebody else in the front row when OAN and the Secret Service was brought in, and we all, like, as a press corps, like, basically stood up and prevented it from happening. But I mean, once again, this will be from day one. Are they going to be pulling credentials? Are they going to be, we'll go to court to fight it again? But I mean, who knows? That's just one level. The other level that you're getting at, will he actually go and try to punish this? Is there a room for Jonathan Swan at Gitmo? There's certainly going to be people around him who, if you believe the rhetoric of what he's actually saying, the enemy of the people, what do you do with the enemy of the people?
Let's move on to another question. While conducting the interviews for this book, was there anything that you heard or learned that truly surprised or shocked you?
There were a number of things, but I have to say that the thing that really shocked me was the extent to which he believed he could be reinstated as president. You know, and I know there's a big debate, and Jack Smith is making the case that Trump knew he lost. Now here I am saying he actually believed he could be reinstated. Does that contradict what's being said? I think his leaving reality was a process, but the idea that an ex-president really thought there was a way that he could go back to the White House short of another election, I think is really shocking.
There's a question here that they say, who do you think are the leaders of the GOP? But I'd like to use my moderator's power, my great power, to rephrase that. Your subtitle, if I'm not mistaken, is something to the effect of the end of the GOP.
The end of the Grand Old Party.
Grand Old Party.
Yeah.
Elaborate on that. When you say the end of the Grand Old Party, what do you mean by that?
It's the way that Donald Trump has been able to methodically remake the Republican Party in his own image. This is not the party anymore of Ronald Reagan, of the Bushes, John McCain, Mitt Romney. And it's not so much substance and policy. There is some policy in there, a move towards isolationism, protectionism, broad brushstrokes, harder line on immigration, okay. But not a lot of specifics behind any of that. This is never really truly about policy. It's about orienting the party towards the whims of one man. And you see the wreckage that he has left in his wake. I mean, I think there is one thing was interesting in Liz Cheney's book. She writes about the message that she got from George W. Bush, cheering her on and talking about the importance of her work when she stood up to Trump. Bush hasn't done that for the most part. He stayed silent in Dallas, and he's done charity work and done some good stuff, and he's worked on his painting. But I don't think it's because he's afraid to. I think that he gets a sense that it would only backfire, that it wouldn't help. I don't know if he's right about that, but I think that's a calculation. I don't even know for sure if that's his thinking, but that's my read of it. I mean, that this party has left those people behind, you know, and it's become Trump's party. Now, I don't think it's irreversible, and maybe we come together and do another one of these. I'll come out and do something in person in San Francisco. We can talk about this and go back and forth. I think it's possible that he loses the nomination still. I don't think that's a given, even though it sure seems that way right now. But I don't think that it's inconceivable that he loses this nomination. And then there's a real reckoning within the party about what to do and where it goes. I also think that it's not just him anymore. The drama that's played out in the House over, you know, McCarthy's saga to become Speaker, the way he got jettisoned. And I mean, all of this is Trump's party, and yet he had virtually no role in any of it directly. But it were all of his diehard acolytes who have carried this about.
And what's really interesting is while the institutional GOP is not particularly recognizable from 10 years ago, in some other ways, it's a healthier party in terms of its appeal among Hispanic voters.
Yeah.
They're doing better. Donald Trump is doing vastly better among Hispanics than Mitt Romney ever did.
Yeah.
He's doing much better among African Americans than Mitt Romney ever did. It's becoming more of a working class party. And it's just an interesting kind of contradiction when you have Donald Trump being the accelerant of the diversification of the Republican base. It's like, you know.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how you think about that phenomenon, because it is part of the story of the last 5-6 years.
Yeah. And he's been a turnout machine. I mean, this is one thing that he rants about when he talks about the election being stolen from him. You know, he got, what was it, 74 million votes, 73 million? And he was told that if he got 68, I mean, I may have the numbers slightly off, but something like that. He vastly outperformed what his own people were saying, what their targets would be. Of course, he's also been an incredible turnout machine for Democrats. And the way women have fled the Republican parties, the way suburban voters have fled, you know, Trump's Republican Party. But there is no question the numbers on Hispanics are significant. The numbers on African-American men, really almost entirely men, still the vast majority voting Democrat.
I mean, Hispanics is almost even now. I mean, it's really amazing. And like the youth, I mean, who knows if this will play out in the election, but like the way he's closed the gap on the youth vote, there's something going on there that I still feel like we don't really have our hands around, like in terms of the electorate, right?
And it's something that Democrats should be terrified about and should be doing a lot of soul searching about. What is it that have caused Democrats to, because I don't know how much of it is, you know, a great appeal to Trump or frustration with the message that is coming from the Democrats.
Right.
I mean, something's not working.
Last question. Covering the news can be exciting and stressful. What is the best part of your job? What is the most challenging?
The best part of the job is having a chance to watch history unfold and to be there and to be able to put questions to the powerful and to always learn something every single day. I mean, that's our job. Jonathan and I, our job is to wake up in the morning and learn something new. How great is that? The worst part of the job is you have no control over your life. You know, let's make plans. What are we going to do? You want to, whether it's trying to make dinner plans or vacation plans, you can be sure, especially when you're covering the White House. I did that basically full time for about a decade. And any news, not just news out of the White House, but any news in the world, you have to get the White House reaction. You need to be on a, you know, you need to be right there. But we are very fortunate to have these jobs. And I know I love it. I know Jonathan Swan loves it. And you're an Australian, I'm an American. I think we both kind of feel that reverence when you walk into the White House, when you walk into the Capitol, when you walk by the Supreme Court, and you know, you realize what these institutions represent, which is also what made January 6th and all that surrounded January 6th so personally painful, to see those institutions that I've had such reverence for under assault and really teetering was really painful to watch and remains painful to watch.
Thank you, Jonathan Carl. I do think in 20 years' time, we'll be looking back at this period as one of the most important turning points in American history. And Jonathan's done so much to fill out that first draft. I'm Jonathan Swan. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for the latest episode of the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today you heard from Jonathan Carl and Jonathan Swan. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the Club. Join us again next week to hear an expert panel discuss whether U.S. national security is in jeopardy. Until then, you can learn more about us and our events at commonwealthclub.org. Find thousands of our programs on Apple Podcasts, Audible, and YouTube. When you're in the Bay Area, join us in person at the Commonwealth Club of California.
From the heart of America's wine country, you are on Jazzy 93.7. KJZY. Sebastopol.
Hey there, and welcome to the Dave Koz Radio Show. I'm your host, Dave, and I hope you're having a safe and joyous holiday season so far. Thank you very much for being here. We have a very special show planned for you as the year comes to